This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Ow. Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy rinse-free whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for two shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White, a whiter smile without the rinse.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, October 6, 2021. Senate Democrats say they will accept an offer from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell to raise the federal debt limit for 2 months to avoid a default in just 2 weeks. Both Democratic President Joe Biden and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell accusing the other party today of, quote, playing Russian roulette with the economy. We'll have the latest in just a moment. Also today, a Senate committee considering the latest voting rights reform bill introduced by Democrats, named for late Congressman John Lewis. And on COVID-19, White House announces $1 billion will be spent to help more Americans get the new at-home rapid coronavirus tests that are now being approved. From the Hill newspaper, Democratic senators on Wednesday signaling they will accept a proposal by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to raise the debt limit for 2 months to avoid a potential economic crisis. Senator Tammy Baldwin noted that accepting McConnell's offer to vote to raise the debt limit to a certain number high enough to cover the nation's financial obligations until December would amount to a temporary victory. She said, in terms of temporary lifting of the debt ceiling, we view that as a victory, a temporary victory with more work to do. Some reaction to the proposal from the White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki.
Jen, you know, Congress has passed countless short-term government funding measures. They have funded the government for 48 hours before. Wouldn't a short-term debt ceiling hike be preferable to default?
The preference would be just getting this done today so we can move on to more business for the American people. And that option is still on the table.
But the White House brought in all of these banking CEOs today to talk about how catastrophic it would be if the U.S. were to default. Why not send the markets that assurance, if you have the opportunity, that at least for the next 8 weeks, the debt ceiling is going to be secure?
Well, if we're looking at the best options, why kick the can down the road a couple of more weeks? Why create an additional layer of uncertainty? Why not just get it done now? That's what we're continuing to press for, and that's our first choice.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. More from the Hill newspaper reporting on this. Republican leader Mitch McConnell issuing the statement shortly after a Senate Republican caucus lunch, announcing he'll allow Democrats to increase the nation's borrowing authority for 2 months without having to use the cumbersome and time-consuming budget reconciliation process to avoid a filibuster. But the catch is that Senator McConnell will require Democrats to vote on a higher debt limit number, something they would be required to do under the Senate's budget reconciliation rules, instead of only voting on legislation to spend the debt limit to sometime after next year's midterm election. Well, earlier in the day, when it looked like a procedural vote on the original debt limit increase bill was going to happen as scheduled, Senator Mitch McConnell explaining on the floor why he would oppose it. He said it's the same reason that he's been giving for months.
Now, it's not clear whether the Democratic leaders have wasted 2.5 months because they simply cannot govern, or whether they are intentionally playing Russian roulette with the economy to try to bully their own members into going back on their word and wrecking the Senate. Either way, it is exactly the kind of recklessness that has this unified Democratic government's public approval in total freefall. Freefall. Even now, while the Democratic leader complains that he's short on time, he continues to waste time with partisan stunts that are dead on arrival. He scheduled yet another vote this afternoon, which he knows will fail. The majority has known for 3 months that show votes like this would go nowhere. This year, Democrats requested and won new powers to repeatedly reuse the reconciliation process. In the past few days, Democrats in both the House and Senate have publicly admitted their party could handle the debt limit that way. Our colleagues have plenty of time to get it done before the earliest projected deadline. There would be potential for time agreements to wrap it up well before any danger. But the Democratic leaders wanted solutions. They wanted to turn their failure into everybody else's crisis, playing risky games with our economy, using manufactured drama to bully their own members, indulging petty politics instead of governing. Their entire failed approach to governing, in a nutshell, on full display for the country to see.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, on the Senate floor. Again, that was when it looked like that procedural vote was going to happen. It was delayed as Senator McConnell offered a proposal to raise the debt limit for just 2 months. Here is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, urging the Republicans to reconsider on that original vote.
In America, Mr. President, we've always kept a basic promise. We pay our debts on time without exception. It's been a key to our economic success and our standing in the global markets across the world. Today, it's time for us in this chamber to do our jobs and make sure those promises remain unbroken. In order to preserve the full faith and credit of the United States, the Senate must act, and by the end of this week, send a bill to President Biden's desk suspending the debt ceiling and allowing our government to keep paying its bills and meeting our outstanding obligations. Later this afternoon, the Senate will vote on cloture on the House passed message that would suspend the debt ceiling through December 2022. If cloture is invoked, the Senate will then vote to pass this bill on a simple majority basis. Democrats have been clear from the start. We're going to do the responsible thing and vote to allow the U.S. to keep paying its bills. Every single one of us is going to vote for cloture this afternoon. For months, Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans have insisted they want a solution to the debt ceiling, but only if Democrats do all the work by themselves. We've already presented Republicans with numerous opportunities to do what they say they want, including by offering a simple majority vote so Democrats can suspend the debt ceiling on our own, as Republicans have asked. But each time, Republicans have chosen obstruction and kept us, unfortunately, on a path to default. Republican obstruction on the debt ceiling over the last few weeks has been reckless. It's been irresponsible. But nonetheless, today, Republicans will have an opportunity to get exactly what they kept asking for. And the first and easiest option is this. Republicans can simply get out of the way, and we can agree to skip the filibuster vote so we can proceed to final passage of this bill.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor earlier today. While this was happening at the White House, President Joe Biden meeting about the debt ceiling issue with a group of business leaders, including the CEOs of J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Intel, Raytheon, also the leaders of the National Association of Realtors and AARP. Here is the president.
There's a Senate vote today to raise the debt limit. Traditionally, it needs only 50 votes. We were informed by our Republican friends that they had to be all Democrat votes. They weren't going to help. I said, okay, we'll provide 50 votes. The definition in the Democrats, we have the votes. The Democrats are willing to step up and stop this economic catastrophe if Senate Republicans will just get out of the way. But our Senate Republican friends are planning to block the vote to raise the debt limit by using the procedural power called the filibuster. To say that in plain English, it means you have to have 60 votes when there's a filibuster. 60 votes, a supermajority, instead of 50 to get anything done. It's not right, and it's dangerous. The reason we have to raise the debt limit is in part because of the policies of the previous administration, which incurred nearly $8 trillion in bills in 4 years, some of which Democrats voted for. More than a quarter of all the debt now outstanding. We had to raise the debt limit three times, when Donald Trump was president. And the Republicans moved to raise it each time, and each time the Democrats supported the effort to raise the debt. But now Republicans won't raise the debt limit despite being responsible for what the debt limit, why it has to be raised, for the bills that are outstanding. They won't raise it enough through, if done, we're going to be defaulting on a debt that would lead to self-inflicted wounds that risk the market tanking and wiping out retirement savings and costing jobs. Defaulting on the debt, which Secretary Yellen said could happen at any day after October the 18th, as we run out of money, means that Social Security benefits will stop, salaries to service members will stop, benefits to veterans will stop, and much more. The failure to raise the debt limit will undermine the safety of the United States Treasury securities, threaten the reserve status of the dollar as the world currency and that the world relies on, downgrade America's credit rating, and result in a rise in interest rates for families, talking about mortgages, auto loans, credit cards. My friends, and there are many of my friends, the Senate Republicans' position I find to be not only hypocritical, but dangerous and a bit disgraceful, especially as we're crawling our way out of a pandemic that cost America 700,000 lives thus far, and we're still battling it. Our markets are rattled. America's savings are on the line. The American people, your savings, your pocketbook are directly impacted by this stunt. It doesn't have to be this way. My Republican friends need to stop playing Russian roulette with the U.S. economy.
President Joe Biden at the White House. White House Council of Economic Advisors also on a blog post warning a default of the debt limit by the nation would fundamentally hinder the federal government from serving the American people and have serious and protracted financial and economic effects. The post goes on, everyone in America would feel the effects of a default. If the U.S. were to default, tens of millions, including families with children, retirees, and veterans, would quickly, even overnight in some cases, face the prospect of losing their homes and their housing. And again, just bringing you up to date, all of this taking place earlier in the day, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell offering a proposal to raise the debt limit for just 2 months. Some indications from the Senate Democrats they might accept that. There was some talk, though, of changing the Senate filibuster rules to allow the debt ceiling to be raised without having to clear the 60-vote procedural hurdle. But to do so would require that all 50 Senate Democratic Caucus members agree. And today, one of them, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said he's opposed to that idea.
On the default that we're the crisis that we have a time zone and time table for, we are not going to default as a country. We will not default. That's the responsibility we have as senators, as congressmen, as 535 of us responsible to protect this great country in an equal branch of government. I truly implore both leaders, my caucus leader is, and the majority leader is Chuck Schumer, and the basically the minority leader is Mitch McConnell. I implore them to engage, start working, work this out. There should not be a crisis. I've been very, very clear where I stand on the filibuster. I don't have to repeat that. I think I've been very clear. Nothing changes. But the bottom line is we have a responsibility to be the adults. Our leadership has the responsibility to lead. And that's what I'm asking and imploring them to do. We should not have these artificial crises. We are not going to default on our debt. We are still basically the currency of the world, and we will remain that. So anybody who thinks any different than that is basically speculating for the sake of theatrics. Let's get on with the business of this country and making sure that people have the opportunities. Get through this COVID crisis that we have right now with the variant. Please accept the science and get vaccinated. Please help us move forward. This is what we're asking everybody to do.
Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, with reporters outside of his office on Capitol Hill. Again, it looks like the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has offered to the Democrats a 2-month short-term debt limit increase extension. So the issue would then go to December, and all indications are the Democrats will be accepting that offer. Stay with C-SPAN for the latest on this issue. Senator Manchin, also one of two Democratic senators deeply involved in the negotiations over how big the social spending and tax bill will be, the one expected to pass through the budget reconciliation process that requires all members of the Democratic caucus to vote yes, assuming all Republicans will vote no. Today, Senator Manchin explained why the initial $3.5 trillion price tag was too big, why he proposed the $1.5 trillion, although willing to go up a bit more on that number.
I've been very clear when it comes to who we are as a society, who we are as a nation, and why we are still the hope of the world. I don't believe that we should turn our society into an entitlement society. I think that we should still be a compassionate, rewarding society. I think that fares best for all of us. But compassion means taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, whether they're young, whether they've had some type of a challenge in life, whether it be mental or physical. Those are responsibilities that we have, and we can all meet those responsibilities. And I feel very strongly about that. And we will continue. This is going to take time to get this done. Getting it done quickly is not going to benefit anybody. So let's make sure that we do it and do it right.
Senator Joe Manchin. And responding later to Senator Manchin at his own news conference, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, chair of the Budget Committee, and the one who has said he would prefer a budget reconciliation bill even larger than the $3.5 trillion that Senator Manchin says is too much.
Now, Senator Manchin, as I understand it, talked about today about not wanting to see our country become an entitlement society. Well, I am not exactly sure what he means by that. Does that mean that we end the $300 direct payments for working class parents, which have cut childhood poverty in this country as a result of the American Rescue Plan, in half? Is protecting working families and cutting childhood poverty an entitlement? Does Senator Manchin think we should once again have one of the highest levels of childhood poverty of any major country on earth? At a time when millions of seniors in Vermont, in West Virginia, all across this country, have teeth in their mouths that are rotting, when they can't afford hearing aids in order to communicate with their grandchildren, and when they can't afford a pair of glasses in order to read a newspaper, does Senator Manchin really believe that seniors are not entitled to digest their food and that they're not entitled to hear and see properly? Is that really too much to ask in the richest country on earth that elderly people have teeth in their mouth and can see and can hear? Does Senator Manchin not believe that we have to end the absurdity of the United States paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, sometimes 10 times more for a particular drug than is paid in Canada or other countries around the world? Does Senator Manchin believe that we should be the only major country on earth not to guarantee paid family and medical leave, and that working mothers should not be able to stay home with a child who is sick? Are workers not entitled to be able to do that?
Senator Bernie Sanders, chair of the Budget Committee, at a news conference on Capitol Hill. Senator Joe Manchin and another Democratic senator, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, the two key senators involved in the negotiations on how big this social spending and tax bill will be. You can find Senator Bernie Sanders' full news conference at our video library, cspan.org. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 102, NASDAQ up 68, S&P up 17. From the New York Times, the White House on Wednesday announced a billion-dollar investment in at-home rapid coronavirus tests that it said would help quadruple their availability by later this year. By December, 200 million rapid tests will be available to Americans each month, with tens of millions more arriving on the market in the coming weeks. Jeffrey Zients, the White House COVID-19 coordinator, said at a news conference. He also said the administration would double the number of sites in the federal government's free pharmacy testing program to 20,000. Here is part of the virtual briefing of the White House COVID-19 response team and coordinator Jeffrey Zients.
On Monday, FDA authorized a new rapid at-home test from Akon Laboratories, which will bring tens of millions more rapid at-home tests to the market. Over the past day, we've also received commitments from two manufacturers, Quidel and OraSure, to further expand manufacturing and speed up their production of rapid tests, taking months off their timelines and adding tens of millions of tests per month to their production capacity. And today we're making another $1 billion investment to further mobilize testing manufacturers. This means companies will be able to expand production of tests even further based on the United States government's commitment to procure an additional 180 million rapid tests over the course of the next year, with tens of millions more tests coming to market over the course of the next 30 days. Thanks to the president's actions in September, we were on track to double the supply of rapid home tests available on the market each month by early November. Authorization of the new ACON test on Monday accelerates this pace, and we are now on track to triple the number by early November. And then today's $1 billion investment to further expand testing production puts us on track to quadruple the amount of at-home rapid tests available for Americans by December.
Jeff Zients leads the White House COVID-19 response team, part of today's virtual briefing. And in the fight against another deadly disease, the World Health Organization endorsing its first vaccine to combat the most deadly form of malaria among children. The hope is to reduce the hundreds of millions of yearly fatalities among young Africans, the vaccine produced by British company GlaxoSmithKline. From the Associated Press, an 18-year-old student opened fire during a fight at his Dallas area high school on Wednesday, injuring four people and then fleeing before being taken into custody hours later, authorities said. Timothy George Simpkins was taken into custody without incident and charged with multiple counts of aggravated assault with a gun, the Arlington Police Department tweeted. As this was all unfolding, and before the suspect was apprehended, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas spoke about the shooting at the start of a news conference in Washington, D.C. on a different issue.
Before we start, I just want to take a minute to acknowledge the shooting that occurred this morning at Timberview High School in Arlington, Texas. It is a developing situation. Details are still coming out. As we understand from police reports, it appears there are four injuries. At present, it appears there are no fatalities. That obviously could change. And it's being reported that the incident began as an altercation between two students. All of those details are preliminary, and as more facts are discovered, we will learn what occurred there. But right now, I know all of us are lifting up in prayer the students and the teachers and the first responders and the parents. And there have been far too many of these at far too many schools. And so we are grateful for the courage and the heroism of the first responders. And we are hopeful that all of the students or individuals who may have been injured will come through and survive.
That's Senator Ted Cruz of Texas about noon Eastern in Washington. As this was happening in his home state, later the suspect, who had fled by car, was arrested. He does face multiple criminal charges. The assistant police chief in Arlington, Texas, says three of the four injured are students and three of the four were taken to the hospital for treatment. Washington Today continues in a moment.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Find it on the C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. This from Politico.com. Richard Donahue, formerly the Justice Department's second-in-command, appeared for a closed-door interview on Friday with the select panel investigating January 6th, according to two sources familiar with the matter. The interview, one of the panel's first, comes as its investigators accelerate their probe of the events leading up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Donahue's tenure at the Justice Department in the final days of the Trump administration has drawn scrutiny from lawmakers as they explore the former president's attempts to pressure the department to interfere in the 2020 election. That was from Politico. And former 24-year Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio is running for mayor of his hometown, Fountain Hills. Arpaio got nationwide fame for his approach to illegal immigration and law enforcement in general. It led to many lawsuits. He lost re-election as sheriff in 2016. He is 89 years old. The Senate Judiciary Committee took up the issue of voting rights today, considering a bill titled the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, named after the late Georgia congressman and civil rights activist. The bill seeks to reverse recent Supreme Court decisions that change under what conditions a state must get federal government approval to alter voting laws, known as preclearance. One of the witnesses today, Kristen Clark, Assistant Attorney General, arguing that reform is needed.
Recently, there's been a resurgence in attacks on voting rights, including cuts to early voting periods, burdensome restrictions to register or vote, racially gerrymandered redistricting plans, polling sites eliminated or consolidated in communities of color, eligible voters purged from the rolls, and more. I am here today to sound an alarm. For the Justice Department, restoring and strengthening the Voting Rights Act is a matter of great urgency. The Supreme Court's 2013 Shelby County versus Holder ruling suspended the preclearance process, eliminating the Justice Department's single most powerful and effective tool for protecting the right to vote. Before Shelby, the preclearance process enabled the department to swiftly block the implementation of many discriminatory and unconstitutional voting practices. Through Section 5, the department blocked over 3,000 voting changes, helping protect the rights of millions of citizens. In over 60% of blocked voting changes, there was evidence of intentional discrimination. We also know that the preclearance requirement deterred many jurisdictions from adopting discriminatory changes in the first place. Too many jurisdictions have viewed the Shelby ruling as an invitation to adopt rules that disadvantage minority voters. Today, jurisdictions that want to restrict voting rights have what the Supreme Court memorably described the advantage of time and inertia. These new laws can be challenged only through long, protracted, resource-intensive, case-by-case litigation, which we have pursued in states like Texas and North Carolina.
Assistant U.S. Attorney General Kristen Clark testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The committee's ranking Republican Chuck Grassley of Iowa spoke in opposition to the reform proposal.
Preclearance worked wonders in 1965. It was needed to ensure the vote for minority communities that were denied the right to vote by poll taxes and literacy tests. Those laws have thankfully been erased from the books. We have recently had record turnout for minority voters. So why are we expanding preclearance in 2021? Do we really want the Department of Justice exerting this level of control over our states? This is the same DOJ that only yesterday distributed a memorandum vaguely threatening to use the FBI to investigate parents protesting school teaching critical race theory in the classroom if those protests, quote unquote, intimidate school board members. Do we really want to give partisan activists who claim that paying for postage stamps to mail in a ballot is a poll tax the ability to subject a state to burdensome federal regulations and oversight? Do we really want to give Democratic operatives unfettered power to bring states under preclearance with lawsuits resting on vague notions of quote-unquote violations?
Senator Chuck Grassley at today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. And joining us now with more on this voting rights reform bill is Jordan Williams, a reporter with The Hill. Thanks so much for being with us. What would this bill do?
Well, in a nutshell, know, the bill would restore sections of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that within the past several years have been gutted by Supreme Court decisions. So it aims to strengthen Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which was notably gutted this year by the Brnovich versus DNC Supreme Court decision, and also strengthen Section 5, which gives the DOJ the ability to, you know, screen new voting rules in areas that had a history of voting restriction. Sorry, racially motivated voting restriction. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
The bill was introduced by Democrats. What has been the Republican reaction? Will any Republicans support it?
It appears not to be the case, and it's been the case with just about any other, you know, voting reform that we've seen this year. You know, voting rights have been a pretty hot button issue for Democrats this year in the wake of, you know, a slew of, it was something along the lines I was saying, was it 30 bills that were passed across state legislators that advocates say roll back voting rights. So this year, Democrats have really been trying to counter that at the federal level, but in an evenly tied Senate, that's going to be virtually impossible.
Can we expect this bill to come up for a vote in the Senate this year?
If I had to take a guess, I would likely see an attempt. I wouldn't be too confident in that, because obviously, as we've discussed, any form of voting rights legislation is almost guaranteed to get filibustered. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw an attempt to get it on the floor just to get, you know, Republicans on record about how they feel about voting rights.
Jordan Williams, reporter with The Hill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Possible 2024 Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley speaking Tuesday night at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. She's also a former South Carolina governor and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under the Trump administration. Los Angeles Daily News reporting that Haley didn't pull any punches when it came to what she conceived as current threats to the United States and bashed the Biden administration in the same breath. She slammed Democrats, saying they don't believe in America and see the country's flaws as more profound than its strengths. Here's part of her speech.
As my great predecessor, UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, famously said, in Reagan's time, the left was happy to, quote, blame America first. Today's Democrats don't even believe in America. We've reached a place where the President and the Vice President of the United States routinely accuse America of systemic racism. Virtually every elected Democratic politician agrees with them. This is an astonishing turn of events. Just 17 years ago, Barack Obama gave the speech that launched him on his way to the White House. It was at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. This is one of the most noted passages from his speech. Then Senator Obama said, quote, "We are one American family. There's not a black America and a white America, a Latino America and an Asian America. There's the United States of America. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the stars and stripes." Can you imagine any prominent Democrat making that statement today? I can't. Democrats have given up on America as a colorblind society. They see America's flaws as more profound than its strengths. They deny the massive progress we've made, and they punish anyone who disagrees. They are quick to praise those who attack America and eager to attack those who praise America. Democrats have abandoned Barack Obama's unifying message on race and national identity. Republicans cannot make the same mistake. That message was our message first. We must once again take it to the American people. We're fighting for a society where people are judged by actions, not color, where discrimination is ended, not embraced, where censorship is rejected and free speech is protected. We want a country that cherishes its principles and takes pride in its progress. And we know the only way to bring out the best in America is to believe in America. We must not be ashamed of the American story. We should tell it everywhere we go. We know that some of it's hard to hear. The founders weren't saints. They lived in a time in which slavery was legal and women's rights were an afterthought. We don't need to make excuses for those obvious injustices, but we can't act like that's all the country is. The left is so focused on what was wrong, they missed the profound things America got right.
Nikki Haley, former South Carolina governor, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, speaking Thursday night at the Ronald Reagan Library in California. She is the fifth Republican speaker this year in the library's series titled Time for Choosing, which refers to the 1964 speech by then activists and former actor Ronald Reagan on behalf of Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, launching Reagan into national prominence. Earlier this year, Nikki Haley said that she would support former President Donald Trump if he runs for president in 2024 and not consider her own bid then. Andrew Yang ran for president in 2020 and then New York City mayor this year, both times as a Democrat. This week, he announced he's leaving the Democratic Party. He was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal this morning to explain why.
I left because of the polarization that unfortunately threatens to tear our country apart. I like C-SPAN in part because you really do just present unfiltered politics and news. But if you look around, right now we have these media institutions that are actually inflaming tensions and polarization in different ways. And I thought that there was a way and a need, a pressing need, to help bring the temperature of our country down. And that's why I left the Democratic Party to become an independent and start the Forward Party, which will be this unifying popular movement to change the incentives of our political leaders to actually respond to the reasonable among us and not the extremes on either side. Because right now, if you look at the numbers, and I'm a math guy, independents outnumber registered Democrats and independents almost, registered Democrats and Republicans almost 2-1. In some surveys, and yet we know that that point of view is often getting lost.
What part of being part of a major party was inflaming to you, as particularly being part of the Democratic Party?
Oh, I mean, I didn't feel particularly inflamed, I suppose. I was a Democrat for 26 years, ever since I could register to vote. But right now, We're seeing a dysfunctional system where we're not able to get anything done on either side. And I think people who are watching this at home can relate to that. And if you're a reasonable person watching at home, you're scratching your head being like, why is it that our leaders seem so unreasonable relative to really anyone else you can find? And the answer is that those are the incentives of our system, where right now, if you become an elected representative, you don't answer to 51% of the population, much as we'd like to pretend otherwise. So who do you answer to? You answer to the 10 to 20% of the most partisan voters who will vote either Democratic or Republican in your district. 83% of districts are safe seats. So they're either gonna be very blue or very red. Right now, and I can sense even from the people who are calling in, the approval rate for Congress nationally is only 28%. People don't love what's going on or not going on. But the re-election rate for individual members is 92%. People are going to win election over and over again, in part because, again, they're catering to the base on either side. And then when they come together, they can't get anything done. So that's the system as it's currently set up. We're all fed up by it. We're all frustrated. And this is the biggest thing, is that we're being sold a bill of goods that is actually intended to work when it's actually not designed to work. And so what I want to do is actually get into the guts of the real problems that I talk about in my book. And that isn't just a Democratic problem or a Republican problem. It's a system-wide problem. And so that's why I had to leave the Democratic Party to try and get this work done.
Andrew Yang, former presidential candidate on C-SPAN's Washington Journal on Wednesday morning. The title of that book is Forward, Notes on the Future of Our Democracy. As he mentioned, he started a new party called the Forward Party, and he's got a new political action committee associated with it, Forward Party PAC. From Bloomberg.com, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken criticized China's recent military maneuvers around Taiwan, urging leaders in Beijing to stop such behavior for fear of a miscalculation. Blinken spoke in an interview in Paris with Bloomberg Television. Bloomberg notes that China has ratcheted up tensions around Taiwan in recent weeks, sending scores of warplanes into the island's air defense identification zone. At the same time, the U.S. and several allies, including Japan and the United Kingdom, have been conducting naval drills in nearby waters. Blinken also asked about this during a news conference at a meeting at the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, headquartered in Paris.
With regard to Taiwan, I have to tell you and reiterate that we are very concerned by the PRC's provocative military activity near Taiwan. As we said, the activity is destabilizing, it risks miscalculation, and it has the potential to undermine regional peace and stability. So we strongly urge Beijing to cease its military, diplomatic, and economic pressure and coercion directed at Taiwan. We have, the United States has, a commitment to Taiwan that is rock solid and over many years has contributed to the maintenance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and within the region. And we will continue to stand with friends, with allies, to advance shared prosperity, shared security, shared values, as well as continue to deepen our ties with a democratic Taiwan.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in France. President Joe Biden telling reporters Tuesday night that he has spoken to the Chinese President Xi Jinping about Taiwan and they agree to abide by the Taiwan Agreement. Those are the words from President Biden. Reuters writes that he appeared to be referring to Washington's longstanding policy under which it officially recognizes Beijing rather than Taipei, and the Taiwan Relations Act, which makes clear that the U.S. decision to establish diplomatic ties with Beijing instead of Taiwan rests upon the expectation that the future of Taiwan will be determined by peaceful means. Pope Francis expressing sadness, pain, and shame over a new report showing at least 330,000 children were abused sexually by clergy and lay members of church institutions in France over the past 70 years. The Pope speaking during one of his general audiences with pilgrims at the Vatican.
Brothers and sisters, yesterday the Episcopal Conference on the Conferences of Men and Women Religious in France received the Independent Commission's report regarding sexual abuse in the church, which was commissioned to evaluate the extent of the phenomenon of sexual aggression and violence committed against minors since 1950 to the present. Unfortunately, a considerable number was revealed. To the victims, I wish to express my sadness and my pain for the traumas they have endured and my shame or embarrassment, our shame, my shame, that for so long the church has been incapable of putting this at the center of its concerns. And I assure them of my prayers. I pray, and we all pray, to you, Father, the glory, to us, shame. This is the moment of shame. I encourage the bishops and you, dear brothers, who have come here to share this moment. I encourage the bishops and religious superiors to continue to take every means so that similar tragedies might not be repeated. I express my closeness and fatherly support to the priests in France in the face of this trial, which is difficult but beneficial. And I invite the Catholics in France to assume their responsibility to guarantee that the church might be a safe home for everyone.
Pope Francis, that audio coming from Vatican News. The Guardian newspaper out of Great Britain has a story that on Wednesday, a Vatican tribunal absolved a former altar boy of charges that he molested a younger boy in the Vatican's youth seminary in the first clergy sexual abuse trial to be heard by the Pope's criminal court. Thanks for listening to Washington Today, and for more top Washington stories delivered right to you, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word at c-span.org/connect. I hope you have a good evening.